This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Gareth Porter, who you have heard many times in Takes on the World, is an independent investigative journalist and historian who has been among the top U.S. security investigators since the Vietnam War. His articles can be found in Consortium News, The American Conservative, and Truth Out, among other publications. His latest book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of Iran Nuclear Scare, was published in February 2014. Today, he's one of a handful of journalists who have been facing down the anti-Russian and anti-Iran hysteria while reporting on the efforts by key individuals such as John Bolton to have President Trump decertify the nuclear treaty negotiated with Iran by the Obama administration and the members of the U.N. Security Council, plus Germany, and provoke a war with Tehran. Today we're going to discuss with him his recent article in the American Conservative, The Untold Story of John Bolton's Campaign for War with Iran. Welcome once again, Gareth Porter, to Takes on the World.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Jeff.
You know, we have seen over the years a number of neocons calling for the U.S. to take a more aggressive stance with Iran, both before and after the deal negotiated with Iran by John Kerry and other Security Council members plus Germany. What makes John Bolton different?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really a matter of degree. I mean, it's true that there are a number of neoconservatives who have called for basically a war against Iran over the years, particularly if you go back to 2007, 2008, 2009. But Bolton has continued to do so with alarming regularity since he left the Bush administration in 2007. In fact, he's become, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, a regular contributor to Fox News, and is called upon almost on a weekly basis, if not even more than that, more recently. And for many years, every time he has been on Fox News to talk about Iran, he has reiterated his call for bombing Iran. So he represents just the most extreme view on this question, in which, you know, there are obviously many extremists representing, the Zionist viewpoint of, that Iran represents a dire existential threat to Israel and should be taken out. He also is a very peculiar case, because when he was in the Bush administration, we know that he maneuvered in conjunction with Vice President Dick Cheney to create political conditions under which the Bush administration could ultimately use military force against Iran. And that's why, he's not simply a blowhard. He's not simply somebody who voices that view in public, but somebody who has actually carried out policies and private maneuvering that were aimed at bringing about precisely that result. And so, it's really part of a larger story. He's part of a larger story, I should say, of the group led by Dick Cheney in the Bush administration, who were determined, we know, to carry out a policy that would result in using military force against Iran. I've written about that on a number of occasions. I talk about it in my book, and if you want, we can go into greater detail, but I think that's the key point about Bolton that is really so alarming.
Well, also you mentioned of his meetings in Israel while he was technically under the supervision of Colin Powell, but you say he was working, in fact, for Dick Cheney, but he used that position, as also as he used his UN position, to collude with Israel, which has had Iran in its hairs or targets for quite some time. Maybe you talk about the Mossad role, his role with that.
Yes. It's very important to understand that Bolton had more than one hat. On one hand, he was the policymaker in the State Department on weapons of mass destruction and proliferation. On the other hand, he was also the point of contact in the administration with Israel. And that gave him an extraordinary position with which to collude, as you correctly put it, with the Israelis on a strategy for maximizing the chances of having a situation where the United States could carry out a military attack on Iran. And in my book, I describe the fact that he had more than one unauthorized trip to Israel. And by that, I mean that he took more than one trip, which was not given authorization by the State Department, as is required by State Department rules. Anytime somebody travels to a foreign country in the administration, that person has to have the authorization of the regional bureau of the State Department responsible for that country. And he regularly disdained and violated that rule by traveling to Israel without the authorization. And what that meant was that he held meetings with Israeli officials at which there was no one representing the U.S. embassy who could report back to the Secretary of State on what was discussed in the meeting. And of course, at that point, as you mentioned, Colin Powell was Secretary of State, and Powell was well known to be in opposition to many of the policies that Dick Cheney was pursuing, among which was certainly the policy toward Iran. And so one of the people with whom Bolton was meeting on those visits, unauthorized visits to Israel, was the chief of Mossad, Meir Dagan, at that point. And so, although we have no record, of course, for the reason that I've already stated, of what was discussed in the meeting, what I do talk about in my book is that after one of the meetings, there was a decision made by Meir Dagan to create a new, and this was in 2003, to create a new office in Mossad, which would have the function of circulating information, quote-unquote, on the Iranian nuclear program to governments and the news media. And of course, the other piece of the puzzle that I discuss in my book is that we know in 2004 the sudden appearance of the dossier or the collection of documents that supposedly came from a Iranian nuclear weapons research program, but we now know were essentially fake documents and were handed over to Western intelligence by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the former terrorist organization. Was recognized as a terrorist organization for many years until just a few years ago in the Obama administration, and it was working hand in hand with Mossad during that period. That's well established. So that is part of the reasoning that I present in my book for concluding that it was Mossad that manufactured the key documents that were then used to convict Iran of having a nuclear weapons program in world opinion. And I would argue that John Bolton was instrumental in helping to bring that about because of his meetings with Mossad and clearly his support for the general policy of maneuvering to produce a situation where the United States would have a casus belli with Iran.
One of the things that should be quite evident is that Bolton would have no qualms about sharing U.S. intelligence with Israel. He was considered, jokingly, the sixth man in Israel's U.N. office by Israeli Ambassador Dan Gilliman when Bolton, who could not get approval by the U.S. Senate to be the U.N. ambassador, was given a recess appointment by George Bush. But like Nikki Haley is doing now, it seems that being a representative for Israel is part of the job description of a U.S. UN ambassador. But Bolton seems to have taken this position very seriously. I know he's also, until recently, was the chairman of a think tank called the Gatestone Institute,
yes,
which spread the most outrageous Islamophobia, in which you look at it, you would think that Islam has taken over Europe. The man is clearly off his rock. I mean, he's actually frightened a number of your ordinary hawks in Washington. Although the New York Times on Monday gave him a more of a moderate approval in their article, and they actually quoted some people who are ready to now accept him as a possible positive in the Trump administration.
Well, I'm glad you've raised the point. Another a point about his extremism, which is his Islamophobia, and which he has espoused very openly through that Gatestone Institute. And that, by the way, of course, links him to extremist funders who have Zionist connections, particularly Adelson and Robert Mercer. And that's an important aspect of his career, which certainly bears a lot of attention. But the other thing that we haven't talked about, we've focused only on Iran so far, but I think it must be taken into account at this point that he represents even a greater danger in the very short run because of his announced position on U.S. policy toward North Korea. He has called also for a first strike against North Korea, not you know, in an emergency when, you know, there is intelligence of some sort that the North Koreans are loading their ICBM or their long-range missile with a nuclear weapon, but rather right now he's calling for preparing for a first strike against North Korea. And he does so with the explanation that we should not return to the situation or the policy of mutual deterrence. He renounces the whole idea of mutual deterrence. Now, that is the most extreme position that has ever been held by anyone associated with U.S. national security policy at a high level, to my knowledge. I mean, I know of nobody else who has been accepted in a key position of advising the President of the United States who has renounced mutual deterrence. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there was somebody who in the 1950s or 1960s slipped in, but as far as I know, he is alone in that regard. And from my point of view, that should disqualify him for any position advising the president, and makes him the most extremely dangerous character that we've had in any administration thus far.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned earlier that he had been promoted by Sheldon Adelson, who even, it was revealed in the New York Times, was pushing for the ouster of McMaster. And Adelson,
right,
was a major funder of Donald Trump. He gave him at least $35 million. We don't know how much more, or promised how much more. He pushed Trump to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The same Adelson who apologized to an Israeli audience that he had served in a U.S. Army uniform and not in that of Israel, something that the Democrats will not dare even put up because he'll be accused of anti-Semitism, no doubt. But it's a strange situation. And Adelson, it should be remembered, gave auditions to all the Republican presidential candidates before Trump was selected. So the power this Adelson is playing in American society cannot be understated.
I agree with you completely. And I think that this toxic combination of extremism of the extremist positions taken in policy by the new national security advisor on one hand, and the role that you've correctly pointed out is being played by this extremist funder of U.S. elections on the other hand, This is unprecedented in the history of the United States, I think. And you know, there is some reason to believe that Trump's decision to hire Bolton as his national security advisor was at least in some measure influenced by the need of the Republican Party, by the White House and the Republican Party, to have Adelson's money behind Republican candidates in the coming congressional election, because the Republicans are having difficulty keeping up with the Democrats on fundraising. So, I mean, that adds another element to this picture that it just really confounds one's, imagination to think of a worse situation to be in as a nation.
This is Jeff Blankford. You're listening to Takes on the World on KZYX, where my guest today is Gareth Porter. Gareth, I want to just switch subjects for a minute slightly. We have been hearing in the news that the White House, perhaps in conjunction with Britain or France, is planning a strike on Syria because of the alleged use, unproven, of chlorine gas in the town of Douma. And with one of the people the New York Times reported that Trump was meeting with was, of course, Bolton. This is obviously not going to be someone who's going to advise the president to investigate before launching an attack. What do you think can you forecast the immediate future of this situation with Bolton added into it?
Well, I think you're right that Bolton certainly is going to be pushing for shooting before you investigate. That would be his natural bent, as well as the bent of those people who've been funding Bolton all along, particularly Adelson. Who, on behalf of Israel, the Israelis want the United States to go to war in Syria on their behalf. If they clash with Russia, so much the better as far as the Israelis are concerned. That is certainly the way I view it. But what appears to be happening here is that there will be investigators going to Syria, and that at least thus far, the White House is waiting for the results of that investigation. I hope that is the case, and that would be at least a slightly positive note in the sense that it would mean that Bolton is not automatically having his way on this particular issue. At least that would be my surmise.
I mentioned earlier in the program, before I called you, that War Secretary, Defense Secretary Mattis had stated in February that the accusations of that Syria had used sarin gas a year ago were never proven, and that the attack in which the president launched 59 cruise missiles was made without any evidence that Syria had launched a sarin attack on this town in Syria, or in fact that whatever gas was used was sarin at all. It was interesting. This was in February, a statement by ex-General Mattis, which did not get much publicity in the U.S. media. But Tucker Carlson on Fox News, ironically, mentioned it on Monday night, in which he expressed skepticism about the timing of the so-called alleged Syrian attacks, particularly when it follows immediately good news for Syria. For example, in April of last year, the government of the U.S. had kind of recognized that Assad was going to stay in Syria, and so the next thing we know, we have this sarin gas attack. And just after President Trump announced that he was going to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, we have another attack. And obviously,
Let me comment on both points that you've raised. On the first point, I have to say that I think that there's been some mistaken interpretation of what Mattis said in February. He, although I admit, that his remarks were not covered very well in the press, the reports seemed to leave the impression, that he was talking about the Khan Sheikhoun affair, the issue of whether chemical weapons were used, sarin was used in Kanshe Kun. But if you really look carefully at his remarks, he was talking about charges that were being made at that point in previous weeks about new use of chemical weapons. So I think we have to be a bit careful about attributing to Mattis the idea that the attack in 2017 was carried out without any reason. I mean, I don't think that is what he was saying. Who knows what he actually believes? But I do agree with you that the current situation is one that certainly raises very large questions about what the motivation would be on the part of the government for using sarin gas or chlorine gas, or I mean chlorine, of course, not actually a chemical weapon, but to use certainly a chemical weapon under those circumstances would be really a strange decision to be made. And then, you know, we're talking here about a situation where the Jaish al-Islam was negotiating its final exodus from Ghouta and basically ending that concluding part of the civil war, if you will, in Syria. They were very, very close to that agreement. Now, you know, some people would argue, well, this was simply to speed up the process of getting that final agreement. But, you know, the potential risk and cost of doing that obviously seems to me to outweigh any possible gains that you could get from speeding it up. So, you know, this is a case where, you know, without knowing, obviously, the details of the situation on the ground, it certainly is highly suspect. And the idea of making a decision to carry out a military attack before any investigation would certainly be just a completely irrational policy decision. As you know, I did do a very in-depth analysis of the evidence with regard to Kanshe Kun in 2017, a year ago, and concluded that the official position, the official line of the local authorities simply cannot be supported by evidence. The evidence does not support it. And I tried my best to come up with a scenario that would account for the evidence that we have been able to see documented, and concluded that what actually happened was that there was an air attack by the Syrian government in Kanshe Kun against a target that was believed to be a building that would have been used by local officials and which, you know, had supplies of an agricultural chemical that, when it was hit by a bomb, could create a chemical reaction that would mimic the symptoms of nerve gas, but which was not nerve gas at all. I mean, it's a very complicated problem, and I don't expect very many of your listeners would have the patience to wade through it, and I'm afraid very few people have actually done that. But what I'm trying to get at is that in the past, I don't think that the evidence has supported the charges that were, even OPCW supported them, but they did a very poor job of investigating, and I don't think it was worthy of an international organization.
Well, you were one of several people who had questions, and experts who had questions who analyzed it, but unfortunately we don't hear any dissenting views anymore on any of these issues in the mainstream media. For example, the most recent is the case of the deadly nerve agent supposedly ordered by Vladimir Putin to kill a former Russian double agent in Salisbury in England, that was supposedly so deadly that anybody near it or touch it would die. And the daughter, his daughter, is already out of the hospital.
Right.
The policeman was out 3 weeks ago. And still the Boris Johnson, who I call the Donald Trump of England, keeps claiming that, I mean, he looks something like him, and he's just as outrageous, keeps claiming that for 10 years the Russians have been working on this nerve agent as if they're going to blow it by going to Salisbury and killing someone who is no use to them anymore. It's like one, I you know, the last time I interviewed, we talked about this anti-Russian hysteria. This was in July. It seems every day in the New York Times there is some kind of article criticizing Russia. Just the other day, there was much to criticize there. I'm not going to say it isn't, but the other day there was a huge story about ugly, horrible, unhealthy landfills in Russia, in a part of Russia, which is no doubt true. But we have these in the United States that don't get the same attention.
Well, I'm glad you've raised this because, first of all, I want everybody listening to this to know that I am, in fact, working on either one or two articles on the subject of the Salisbury poisoning, which occurred last month, and as one might expect, I've found that the official line doesn't add up at all. And in fact, you know, the dossier, the intelligence dossier that was shared with the United States and other allies as well as European countries by the UK government, the Theresa May government, as represented by, reflected in leaks to various British media, particularly the tabloids, it reveals that this is a worthy successor to the so-called dodgy dossier of 2003, which was so outrageously supportive of the U.S. decision to go to war to invade and occupy Iraq, and has been rightly denounced by almost everyone in the U.K. I find very strong parallels here because there's no real intelligence involved in the dossier. It was speculation and simply far-fetched reasoning based on simply interpretations. This is a classic case of propaganda that parades as or is disguised as intelligence.
Well, it's something that, again, is unquestioned. It seems the word alleged had disappeared from the vocabulary of the U.S. media when it comes to speaking about anything the Russians, the Iranians, or the Syrians may have done.
It's absolutely right, and it's a terribly important point, and it applies, of course, both to British and U.S. media. And I've noticed the same thing with regard to the coverage of the Skripal poisoning issue. Alleged simply is not used. And this is an indictment of the corporate news media in both countries that really needs to be discussed much more widely.
Yes, it's certainly not a question of taking one side or another. It's simply basic journalism.
Absolutely.
And I was looking at the British press in covering this, and even papers that I've respected, like The Independent, were just as crazy in dealing with this issue as were the others. It read like a tabloid.
In fact, the thing that strikes me in reading just about everything that's been published on this subject over the last several weeks since the poisoning is that the more respectable, quote-unquote, the media, the more irresponsible they have been. In a sense, I mean, you know, I'm saying they're all irresponsible. They've all been irresponsible. But it's interesting that it's mostly the tabloids that have published information that is, in fact, useful if you put it all together to come up with at least some glimmer, some insight into what actually happened.
What I pointed out in my introduction before I called you was that whoever was responsible has achieved an amazing outcome that has brought Russia and the West into a greater crisis than at any time since the Cold War. We have diplomats being forced to move. It's like a board game in which some outside player is pulling the strings and laughing at what's going on in front of them. I mean, it isn't.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I mean, this is the primary factor that should be at the center of the coverage. Okay, whose interests are being served here? And of course, that issue is not being addressed at all in either U.S. or British media. But that is certainly a question that I've taken an interest in. And you know, I'm willing to say this on your program. I haven't written anything about it. But look, I mean, one of the countries, one of the parties, shall we say, that clearly has an interest in bringing this about is Israel. And one of the parties that has the capability of creating some kind of nerve agent that would mimic the so-called Novichok nerve agent would be Israel. So this is part of the political context here. I don't think it's realistic to expect corporate news media to ever raise that issue. But I must say it's interesting that former Ambassador Craig Murray, has himself pointed this out, and he's somebody who has a lot of expertise on both intelligence and on chemical weapons. He's a very respected voice on this, and he believes that that's one of the things that ought to be investigated.
You're speaking of former ambassador to Uzbekistan from the UK, Craig Murray, who resigned in protest over Britain's collaboration with the CIA rendition program during the Iraq War, as I recall.
That's correct. Exactly.
He has questioned this whole nerve agent from the very beginning,
He's been vindicated. He's absolutely been vindicated.
You don't see what
he's published on his blog.
And not a word here in the United States about it. And I haven't seen anything in the British press, although I assume there may have been something about it. He's been personally attacked. They haven't forgiven him for his exposing of Britain's collaboration with the U.S. in the Iraq War.
That's absolutely right. Yep.
Actually, we have run down to the end of a very enlightening hour, Gareth. I'm so glad to have you back. I want to tell you, the readers again, the book you've written about the subject of Iran is called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, published in 2014. If it is not in one of your local bookstores, have them order it. Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. You find you're writing on the American Conservative, which has a number of interesting articles. How else can people follow your writing?
Well, I mean, it's a very small group of places where I'm still able to publish, which you've already mentioned, the American Conservative, also Truth Out, Truth Dig, Consortium News, and occasionally I might get into The Nation magazine.
Well, great. Well, Gareth, so great to have you on our guest today on Takes on the World. I look forward to the next time we talk.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Take care. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.